rebuttal, and then each respondent, and I believe we've got, you've filed three briefs, you appear to have one attorney for each of you, have 8 minutes apiece, and then the clock should reflect your time, so you'll just want to keep an eye on that. And then the one other thing I'll say, in addition to welcome, and we're ready to hear your arguments today, is please remember to identify yourself clearly, and just to keep our oral argument record very clear. So you identify yourself, as well as the client that you represent before you start your remarks. So with that, thank you, appellant. I see you're ready to begin.
May it please the court. My name is Jane Voles, and I represent the appellants here, and that is Terry and Vicki O'Brien, who are husband and wife, Shamrock Sod and Landscaping, Inc., and Custom Boardwalks, Inc. Thank you for hearing this case. This has been a long and difficult journey for my clients. And there are several issues in this case, but the issues can be divided into three different buckets. The first bucket is whether or not the district court abused its discretion with regard to punitive damages, the joinder of Suzanne Tisdall and the fraud claim, and whether or not abused its discretion with regard to extending the dispositive motion deadline. The second bucket all involves the summary judgment motions in which the court granted in favor of the defendants. The third bucket is whether or not the district court abused its discretion in allowing the bank to not provide a homestead designation notice under Minnesota Statutes 582.041, which would have allowed my clients to possibly redeem the small piece of property that their double wide trailer sits on, because they foreclosed on the entire property and did not break it up into two parcels and did not provide the notice.
Just to be clear on the facts, how large of a parcel are we talking about?
The parcel that contains their double wide trailer is a little over 1.7 acres, I believe, something like that. And the other parcel is about 14 acres.
So there's so much here. Because there are so many claims made, I just had a few questions about a couple of them. As to intentional infliction of emotional distress, your brief lays out the elements necessary to establish a claim, two of which are actual severe emotional distress and conduct that is extreme and outrageous. Your brief does not identify any conduct that is allegedly extreme or outrageous, and it also doesn't identify any evidence of actual severe emotional distress. So why doesn't either of those omissions in your brief end our review of that claim?
Well, Your Honor, in the brief, it's brought up about how the bank controlled my client's funds. We're talking about one checking account.
And well, I know you might have an argument now, but
right.
We're stuck with what's in the brief.
But that is,
I looked at the section of intentional infliction of emotional distress. The argument is the conduct was outrageous. There's no identification as to that claim as to what conduct you're relying upon. And there is no citation in the record or reference to any evidence of severe emotional distress by any of your clients. Maybe start with the second part first.
Okay, Your Honor.
Am I correct that part of your argument doesn't identify any evidence supporting severe emotional distress?
I am sure, Your Honor, that I could have expanded further, but I was limited on my time or my space. The Court of Appeals denied my request for enlargement of the brief, so
I'm stuck with what's in the brief.
Yes.
So, what is it in the rules that would allow us to look beyond your argument to, I guess, search for ourselves as to what evidence you're relying upon to prove a severe emotional distress by any of your clients?
Well, Your Honor, there are, even though it may not be listed or discussed right under the section on emotional distress, There is evidence in the record that has been filed prior to the bank's motion to summary judgment, making its motion for summary judgment to dismiss that claim on behalf of the bank, and then also affidavits responding to Steve Lindholm's motion for summary judgment.
It's our duty then to go and guess about what evidence you're relying upon as to why the district court got that decision wrong and then analyze it. How would that be fair to a respondent in arguing that the district court's decision should be upheld.
I truly understand your concern, but again, I was limited on space, but the record does show there's affidavits from Terry O'Brien discussing the emotional distress and the physical ramifications of that emotional distress, as well as from Vicki O'Brien. It has been a very, very difficult role for my clients, and I guess that's all I can say.
As to your argument in your brief as to why fraud and fraudulent inducement claims were improperly rejected by the district court, your brief recognizes that each of these claims includes an element of a false statement, but your brief then identifies no statement that the evidence establishes is false. And why doesn't that omission end our analysis of those fraud and fraudulent inducement claims?
Well, part of the fraud and fraudulent inducement claims also requires a duty on the bank of ordinary care. And that's even if you don't find that there's a fiduciary duty. And what the bank did is in the bank statements, they would just make all of these over and over and over, these unilateral deductions from the account.
I mean, I'm not asking as to what argument might support the claim. I'm asking you, given the argument that was made on appeal, that there are certain elements that are necessary for fraud and fraudulent inducement, and usually what happens is a party says, this district court got it wrong by rejecting this claim at summary judgment, and here are the pieces of evidence that show that there's a fact dispute as to whether a false statement was made or some other element. And here, your brief doesn't point us to any particular false statement that you say would support this claim and demonstrate that the district court acted erroneously by granting summary judgment. Why isn't that omission enough for us to leave that issue on those claims at rest?
Well, Your Honor, I believe in our initial brief, in the appellant's initial brief, we brought up several examples, and one of them was how Paul Elmer Lindholm and John Bloom would call Terry O'Brien to the bank to sign documents to clean them up for the bank examiners. And that there's also evidence that he was asked to sign blank documents.
Again, you're talking about factual assertions that are made. I'm talking about when a party says the district court got this wrong, on appeal, arguments generally point us to why the district court got it wrong and what evidence that was there in the record to have avoided summary judgment. And with all due respect, I don't see that in your brief, and I'm wondering if that is a procedural deficiency that prevents us from addressing your argument any further on those claims.
Okay, Your Honor, I thought I addressed each of the elements, and you also probably have to get into, there's an order regarding Steve Lindholm, which has the fraudulent inducement order, and then you have the couple of other orders, one for the bank and one for John Bloom.
How are we supposed to know to go look at those things if you don't?
Well, the problem, Your Honor, is that, for example, for the John Bloom order, there was no findings. The court made no findings other than saying, go look at the Steve Lindholm brief, or order, I'm sorry. And so the orders were not very clear. There were a lot of problems with the orders. So it was difficult to go through each of those elements, but it's my understanding, at least I tried to go through each element and show how there was a genuine issue of material fact for each of the elements for the fraud claims. And if I missed something, I apologize, but the facts in there were all listed in the facts section and the statement of the case.
Maybe you can just tell me now, I didn't see it in that section of your brief. Maybe that's dispositive of the argument on that issue, maybe not, but as you're standing here today, can you tell us what exactly is the false statement that was made that supports the fraud and fraudulent inducement claim?
Okay, there's several false statements. One, like I said, was telling them to come to the bank to sign documents to get everything in order for the bank examiners. That's one false statement. The bank statements themselves can be a false statement because they didn't provide the proper information that really reconciled what was going on with the bank, with that checking account. Remember, it's just one checking account, and it cost over $300,000 for a forensic accounting to figure out what was happening in that checking account.
Maybe I should frame my question more specifically. Would you please quote the false statement or statements that were presented to the district court that you believe should have established a basis for your fraud or fraudulent inducement claims on behalf of the clients?
Well, that's a very broad bucket of things to quote, but hard for me to go back and go through all my briefs for all that has gone on in this case, almost 1,000 different documents filed, but...
Well, give us the most compelling statement of a false statement that was presented to the district court made by any of the defendants that you say engaged in fraud.
Okay, Your Honor. From what I recall, back to the bank examiner information, and then John Bloom made repeated comments to Terry O'Brien that I've gotten it all taken care of, don't worry about anything. One false statement was they sent the first formal default notice to the O'Briens. And remember on this, they've sent two default notices, one in 2013 and one in 2015 after they were sued. They never identified the loans or anything like that. And John Bloom said to my client, you don't have to worry about that. That's just, again, for the bank examiners. And I go back to the, there's also the, there's two notes that were secured by land in Osakis, Minnesota. And they took, they foreclosed on that land. My clients lost that property. And then the bank on those notes that were extinguished changed the collateral because they were under collateralized on equipment to equipment, which was not listed in the notes whatsoever. And then they took money from my clients. Remember, no approval from my clients on withdrawals from these accounts, and applied it to that. And John Bloom said, I've got it all taken care of on the Osakis. Got it all taken care of for Osakis. That's a false statement. That was a false statement. As I stand here today, I am.
What exactly? Tell me the statement that was false and how it affected.
I figured it all out for you, Terry. I got it all taken care of. And what he was doing was taking his money. This is more of a recent situation because it's when he was getting receivables for snow plowing for 2014 and 2015. He said, I've got it taken care of. And he took that money, $110,000 plus interest, and put it on those extinguished notes for Osakis. Clear fraud. It's clear fraud. Sometimes because there was so much concealment here, it's hard to bring up the actual statements. But when you look at what the forensic accountant found and all these things that no one knew, there were over 70 loans. And there are five loans that were unsigned. And the bank took interest on those loans. And there's no rebuttal evidence regarding those five unsigned loans. I mean, this case is crazy. This bank completely took control over my client's stuff, or financial well-being. And my clients have nothing now. They've lost everything. When they came in to start to work with this bank, they had their homestead in Alexandria paid in full, $300,000 of net worth, and now they have nothing, absolutely nothing. And all they did was work every day to feed the monster of the bank. They took almost $1 million in interest in just a little over 9 years. On their own, the bank took it over. So it's a difficult situation with the fraud and fraudulent inducement and the representations because a lot was hidden and concealed. Okay, back to your just punitive damages. You asked about the emotional and physical injury. There's also, they disregarded the rights of my clients because they lost everything. They took over their finances, and that clearly is a high disregard of their rights, and that is set forth in the brief. The next issue regarding the whether the court abuses discretion is regarding Suzanne Tisdall. The court made no findings whatsoever on that case, but did allow the only positive for our case. He did allow the appellants or Shamrock to bring a complaint for breach of contract personally against John Bloom because John Bloom was in business with Shamrock. Okay, he let that claim go through so there could be no prejudice for not allowing the joinder of Suzanne Tisdall. But there's no findings. So we believe that's an abuse of discretion. The third abuse of discretion is changing this dispositive motion deadline, and that was clearly unfair. It was made after the final pretrial hearing, after all the jury instructions were out, after
How is it unfair if at that time you're just on the eve of trial, so all of the evidence that might be marshaled to avoid summary judgment would be ready and available? I don't understand the argument that there was prejudice. If I read your brief correctly, it seems to be that the prejudice is if we don't have enough evidence to avoid summary judgment, we appeal And now we have to wait for the appeal process to go back to trial. I don't understand that the kind of prejudice that we consider.
You're right about that, Judge Ross, but the truth is, the bank already admitted there were genuine issues of material fact with regard to the December 14, 2009 notes. Now the prejudice is, we're going through the whole, we got prepared for trial, people are getting older, my clients are getting sicker, and it's likely, I'm hoping that that will be reversed. There's plenty of evidence of factual disputes. So that is a prejudicial thing that we got to come back a year or two down, hopefully, if you reverse that decision.
The district court is that the kind of prejudice the district court is considering when deciding whether to allow for summary judgment motion?
I can't.
The kind of, well, if this case turns out one way, then down the road, the parties may have a more difficult time at trial.
I can't.
Under the case law, is that good?
It's the Cordenoy, I don't know how to pronounce it, factors determine whether or not there's an abuse of discretion. And I've cited that in the brief, and I can't tell you what the district court was thinking about anything. So it's a
I did look at that case, and it seems to be quite different. The manifest injustice standard in that question in that case was, you've read the case.
Yes.
You cited it. I mean, here you had a party that was a woman who was bringing a medical malpractice claim, and she wanted to bring a claim of medical malpractice based upon negligence and one of, I think, failure to disclose circumstances. And in the end, she lost her expert on the eve of trial by total surprise to her. And the district court at that time said, well, we're going to hold you to, you can have another expert. The next expert came in and gave testimony only as to the negligent non-disclosure, or only as to negligence, but not non-disclosure. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, she should have been allowed to go to trial. You should have allowed an amendment to the scheduling order so that she could have this extra claim, because as a matter of justice, she's got evidence to show that she could win. That's the kind of manifest injustice standard or issue that was going on in Cotroneo. It seems to be very dissimilar to the alleged manifest injustice here. What is the manifest injustice of having a summary judgment decision or process before trial?
And you're right, the Cordenio case is a little bit different, but the manifest injustice is the fact that they didn't get to go to trial and were all prepared. And like I said, we're going to have to wait a long time to go back to trial if that gets reversed, which I believe it will.
It seems like you'll prevail on in this appeal if you can show that there is a disputed issue of material fact as to the summary judgment decision, but that if you don't, then there really is no prejudice as to the court's timing for summary judgment. And if I'm correct about that, correct me if I'm wrong. If I am, your case really hangs on summary judgment on the merits, not on the timing.
I agree. So speaking of summary judgment, the first summary judgment motion made by the bank, we did not respond. Appellants did not respond. They made actually two, one for to dismiss plaintiff's claims against the bank, and then one for part of its counterclaim. And it's true. My clients did not respond. That's in the record. But there is plenty of evidence in the record. There's the special master report. There's numerous motions, numerous responses to Steve Lindholm's motion. There's the motion for punitive damages, the motion, lots of discovery motions. There's plenty of evidence in the record showing the factual disputes and outline showing what the facts are in the case. Some of the factual disputes.
Well, there's a case I've seen. I think it was an Eighth Circuit case. I think I probably cited it back when I was in practice, where the court said, you know, the district court is not obliged to go and plumb the record. It's up to the responding party to point out the disputed issues of fact. Once a summary judgment motion is brought by a defendant, at that point, the district court can simply rely on the fact that there's no response and not go digging around for possible evidence that might essentially stepping in the shoes of the plaintiff to find evidence. Do you agree with that line?
I somewhat agree with that, but the court was quite aware of all of the things that were going on, and especially with regard to the special master report, and there's some very concerning things in the judge's orders. Like, for example, in one of the orders, the order granting Steve Lindholm's dismissal, the judge says, all in all, there are 14 loans. Well, the district court already had the special master report, and there are over 70 loans. So it's as if the district court was not really looking at the record, but I agree that we didn't provide the response, and they had filed for bankruptcy the day of the hearing. They were flat broke. They had nothing. But the law does say you can look at the record. And what is in the record for summary judgment if there's a non-responsive motion?
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Strupp representing Steve Lindholm. And as the court's aware, there's Paul Lindholm, the father, who owned the bank. I represent Steve Lindholm, who purchased the bank. Steve Lindholm was released on summary judgment by an order dated December 22, 2016, which is in the addendum, page 85 of appellants. So I've been out of this case for 2.5 years and brought back in. So I might be a little rusty on the facts. The banking relationship between this bank and appellant started in 2003. Steve Lindholm bought the bank on a closing that occurred December 18, 2012. Steve was not an employee of the bank until he bought the bank and closed December 2012. At that point, all of appellant's loans were in default. And as testified by Mr. Terry O'Brien, in essence, the banking relationship had ended. There immediately began negotiations to try to restructure loans, to sort out the banking relationship undertaken by Mr. Steve Lindholm as the new owner, including a drafted forbearance agreement, which never got signed, an effort at mediation to separately meet and try to mediate, see if agreement could be reached on the forbearance agreement or some other arrangement. That did not occur as appellants canceled the day before. The only loan that occurred after Steve Lindholm bought the bank was this $8,000 loan, $5,000 which was extended. The other $3,000 was subject to conditions which were never met. There was additional collateral taken, which ultimately was released on the basis that appellants indicated they needed that collateral for their daughter. It was a vehicle. Steve Lindholm's involvement in this transaction was strictly a normal banking relationship at the point he became involved. Mr. Berger, Mr. Weir can address all the previous stuff. Mr. Lindholm was not there when that happened, was not involved in that. When he took over, this became a loan workout. And that is exactly what he was attempting to do. His involvement was at all times on that separate basis. Some of the allegations which spill back and forth, and it is a little bit tough to track allegations and then tie facts to the specific legal theories. So sometimes our briefing, I think, is a little bit scattered in response because we're having trouble focusing on what exactly is being claimed, and we had that trouble, quite frankly, throughout this litigation. And there is confusion on appellants on how banking relationships work. All of these transactions were documented by loan documents, and I understand there's an appellant's mind dispute about whether or not certain of the documents are signed. Even if they're not signed, there are other undisputed documents signed that grant the same rights. For instance, security agreements that are undisputedly signed that grant security in all collateral. So even if some of these disputed documents are not signed, it does not matter. The banking documents as signed give various rights, well established under the Uniform Commercial Code, well established under Minnesota law, all laid out in the contracts, including the right of set off. The special master was agreed upon by the parties. The special master was a party suggested by appellants, so they in essence chose the special master and we consented so the special master could go through this process. Now, we are not going to deny that this banking relationship was a little bit messy. Obviously, when this forensic accountant had to become involved and had to track things, it was not a completely normal transaction. We are not going to argue otherwise. But at the end of the day, the special master, in a very thorough process, which cost roughly $300,000, in a very detailed, thorough report, found that all money was accounted for. Because one of the big allegations here was there's missing money. Hence the special master, the finding, no missing money.
When we say all accounted for, some of it, though, am I correct, was directed towards loans that were not in effect.
For instance, the foreclosure you're referring to, the Osakis foreclosure. Foreclosure occurred. Those loans are taken care of by the foreclosure process. Bank employees did not understand that and applied certain of the loan, certain proceeds coming in on those loans. When that was discovered, that was reversed and corrected. And that, of course, is one of the allegations of civil theft. One way or another, that money was rightfully owed to the bank, and at the end of the day was correctly applied, and that was an error on how it was handled. As I indicated, this is not the cleanest bank file in the history of Minnesota. There's no debate about that. Special Master, I think, when you read the report, indicates
that. Why aren't there any damages that might accrue from the misdirection of the funds in some, for some of the loans?
The only damage would be if interest accrued incorrectly because the proceeds had not been correctly applied. Now, my understanding is, and someone can correct me if I've got this factually wrong, is that the records were adjusted to take into account this interest question. That's connected also to the holding funds in checks rather than depositing. But if it had been in a banking, a checking account, it wasn't going to be applied on loans anyway. So I don't think that triggers any unpaid interest. I think it's pretty well limited to the Osakis loan, which has been reversed and corrected. It's important to note that Steve Lindholm absolutely had no personal relationship with O'Brien's, with the appellants. There's no side deals, there's no relationship, there's none of that which triggers any of these special circumstances to trigger a fiduciary relationship duty. Again, this was a troubled loan when the bank transaction closed and promptly moved into that normal conduct. So the allegations that I think remain as argued by appellants against Mr. Lindholm is the fiduciary duty argument that he owed a fiduciary duty and he breached it. As the court is well aware, we need special circumstances. We need something unique, indicating that appellants were relying on Mr. Lindholm. Their argument, I imagine the appellants would make, is there was excessive control. That's probably the only fact here on the special relationship that may or may not apply to Mr. Steve Lindholm. I would argue when it's a troubled loan, what was done here is quite normal in a troubled loan relationship. Appellants cite to some testimony from Mr. Steve Lindholm saying it was not a normal banking relationship. That's because normally we don't have collection efforts underway such as this. So you've got loans that are not in collection. That's normal. This was not a normal banking relationship. It's a very messy relationship. But with that in mind, what occurred here is not out of the ordinary when Steve Lindholm became involved. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Jordan Weir. I represent John Bloom in this litigation. With apologies to Mr. Berger, throughout this litigation, on behalf of John Bloom, as he was throughout the time of the relevant time frame in this case, an employee of the bank, We relied heavily upon the analysis that the bank provided both the trial court and then this court on appeal. And we have throughout this case relied and incorporated the arguments provided by the bank as it relates to John Bloom, because again, John Bloom was always an employee of the bank throughout the time of his relationship as banker for in this case, the appellants. While his relationship was more detailed and more extensive with the appellants, John Bloom's relationship was not that of a fiduciary. The record, though very scant evidence of any kind provided by appellants at the trial court level in response to summary judgment, does not indicate a fiduciary relationship. The arguments provided by the bank, the arguments provided by John Bloom before the trial court, the 15-page affidavit that John Bloom signed under oath and provided in conjunction with the summary judgment motion, along with the more than 40 exhibits provided by Security State Bank and again incorporated into John Bloom's motion for summary judgment, all provide his relationship as being merely that of an arm's length banker. No matter what, if you have an over decades-long business relationship, professional relationship, it's going to be, in essence, friendly. We live in Minnesota, after all. But apart from that, the record in this case does not indicate a further fiduciary relationship. I want to quote...
Which communications trouble you the most between your client and the appellant as to a suggestion of protection or his role in taking care of them in a way that might suggest a fiduciary relationship?
My answer might surprise you, Judge Ross, but there are none in the record that John Bloom made that were false.
I'm talking about records or communication that might suggest that might have given the O'Briens a sense that they can trust that he's taking care of their account in a way that might be more than one would expect an arm's length banker to be engaging in.
Right. And I should have been clearer with my answer, but the answer is in the record before the trial court, at the time the trial court was considering summary judgment, which is the only record before this court for examination of whether the trial court properly applied the law to the facts, there is no record evidence of a false statement by John Bloom. There's no record of a fraudulent statement by John Bloom. To the extent there was a statement that I'll take care of you, number one, I have not seen in the briefs provided by appellants in this case a reference to the record evidence before the court, which again is the limitation of purview for this court, of a false statement such that is provided in the briefs. The briefing suggests that there was this relationship, no reference or citation to the record. The briefing suggests that John Bloom made fraudulent statements or he led the appellants along, no citation to the record in the briefs. Again, it's impossible for John Bloom, as Judge Ross pointed out earlier, to respond to such vague argument. Not to mention, the trial court limits its review on summary judgment of the record evidence. In our brief, John Bloom argues that statements by counsel are inadmissible. That isn't an attack of any kind. That is a recitation of a bedrock principle of the rules of evidence. Whether you're talking about summary judgment, you're talking about briefing, or you're talking about arguments before a jury, the statements of counsel are not evidence. All that is evidence would be provided by those with personal knowledge and provided in a timely fashion. Appellants are not afforded a second bite at the apple in this case. They did not oppose the motions for summary judgment. They cannot argue now what they may or may not have argued on summary judgment. They did not oppose the motions.
Well, the district court didn't rely just on the failure to respond. My view of the way district courts can handle these things is simply to say, didn't get a response, I'm not going to go looking any further, but in this case, the district court seemed to go through thoroughly and analyze whether there's a disputed fact, even in the absence of a response. So then don't we look at the evidence the district court had before it, as opposed to simply saying, you didn't respond, you're stuck.
That's exactly right, Judge Ross. And that's, and I'm sorry again if I was unclear with my statement. The bank on summary judgment provided a 67-page brief in support of summary judgment dismissing all the plaintiff's claims. John Bloom provided a 2-page memorandum largely incorporating the arguments provided by the bank because there was no need to further inundate the trial court that was already busy with plenty of other cases other than this one, though the record on appeal in this case might suggest otherwise. The court before it had before it a plethora of record evidence, a plethora of authority, and a very thorough, detailed analysis provided by Security State Bank that incorporated by John Bloom why every single one of the plaintiff's 14 causes of actions that were in part against the bank and in part against all defendants needed to be dismissed. The court, despite the fact that there was no response, that there was no opposition to the motion for summary judgment, incorporated and adopted that analysis after reviewing the record before it, which on summary judgment the court is limited to do. One final point that I wanted to make that I believe disposes of all of the claims, because as Judge Ross also pointed out, what this amounts to is whether the court correctly applied and analyzed these claims under the standard of summary judgment. Every one of these claims, every tort action, is an essential element of damages. And Mr. Strupp touched on it, but I want to quote it in its entirety because this paragraph is very important from the special master's report at the third page. Based upon the forensic accounting and other procedures we performed, we did not identify any Shamrock customer deposits, loan proceeds, cash disbursements, or loan payments that were not accounted for. That is, we did not find any instances where loan proceeds or customer deposits were either not deposited into the checking account, applied against loans, or used to pay Shamrock expenses. The bottom line here is that Shamrock continued, the appellant's business continued at the grace of the bank, and because the bank continued to provide loans to a failing business. There are no damages here, therefore appellant's claim failed as a matter of law and the district court correctly applied the standard and summary judgment. And we respectfully request the court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew Berger with Gisselson & Hunter. I am appearing today on behalf of Security State Bank of Fergus Falls. As the court is well aware from the proceedings this morning, as well as the briefs, this has been a long and painful case. I want to touch on the summary judgment standard here and how to review, because I think that's important here, and the context in which these summary judgment motions arise. On December 23rd, 2016, the bank filed an extensive motion for summary judgment seeking dismissal of the plaintiff's claims in this case. That motion was filed following 18 months of discovery. Seven different bank employees were deposed, some of them twice. There were numerous written discovery requests, numerous documents produced. The plaintiffs in this case had every opportunity to conduct discovery and marshal evidence to support their claims and the damages that they were seeking here. They failed to do so. The bank filed a detailed motion for summary judgment with detailed citations to the factual record and the law, setting forth why there was no genuine issue of material fact. Once that properly filed motion for summary judgment was filed, the plaintiffs then had the burden, and Judge Ross, you alluded to an Eighth Circuit case. There are Minnesota cases. That's it. I say, and I'm referring to Beecroft versus Deutsche Bank, where this court has said, when faced with a properly supported motion for summary judgment, the non-movement must extract specific admissible facts from the record. The district court is not required to page through hundreds of documents in the record to find those facts for the plaintiffs.
Well, the district court did so here. Well, I don't know if the district court went through the record entirely, but the district court does seem to do more than one might suppose is required at the district court. And I suppose the district court judge can simply say the motion is unopposed and there's no need to explore any challenges or any facts that might be offered up in support of the plaintiff's claims. But the district court here did more and thoroughly reviewed the record. You're not suggesting that we shouldn't do the same under our de novo review, or what is your exactly is your argument on this point?
Your Honor, what the district court did was not go through every piece of paper in the record. That would not be appropriate, and that is not the district court's burden. What the district court did, and did appropriately, was review the factual evidence that was referenced in our brief and review those facts to determine whether we had satisfied the requirements for summary judgment. And that was appropriate, and the court determined that we did. And that is appropriate for this court to do, to review the facts that were cited, that were presented to the district court, and determine whether there was a genuine issue of fact based on that, not based on what the plaintiffs, now appellants, after the fact, try to argue, not what they cite in a reply brief or argue here today, but what was before the district court at that time. The review is limited to the specific facts that were before the district court, that were pointed out to the district court and cited, and to the issues that were raised in the district court at that time. This court in Polzin versus Oust, which is cited in our brief, specifically noted that where it's an unopposed motion, the review is limited to what can be raised on appeal in the first instance. And in other words, that's what the district court did here, reviewing the record to determine whether the facts cited show no genuine issue of material fact, whether it was a properly cited motion for summary judgment. If we had submitted a brief that didn't have any citations to the record, didn't have any supporting documents, the district court would have appropriately reviewed that and said, you don't meet the standard. That's not what happened here. Second, Your Honor, I'd like to address the Osakis loans and the question that was raised about why no damages there. And Mr. Strupp answered that, but just to clarify, those loans were extinguished when the bank redeemed from itself. It did not realize the legal consequence of that at the time. It mistakenly kept those loans on the books, but not the real estate. When that was identified, it was corrected. And it was not just corrected at the time, but it was corrected retroactively to the date when it should have been, so that there was no additional interest paid. The second point is all of the other loans that were outstanding at the time were in default. So it is not as if those payments, if they had not been applied to that loan, would have belonged to the plaintiffs. Those payments would have been applied as they were here to the other loans that were outstanding and that were in default at that time. So there were no damages from that instance. It was a mistake. I'm not standing here and saying that it was perfect. A mistake was made. The mistake was corrected. There were no damages.
When was the mistake discovered, and by whom, under what circumstances?
Your Honor, I do not recall the exact date. I believe it was about a month after this litigation started. It was discovered by me when I was reviewing the bank's file and said, hold on a second. What's going on here? The discussion was made. It was corrected.
And you're saying the record would support that it was corrected in a post, in a retrospective fashion?
Correct. And the special master's report identified that as well. I also want to touch on the timing.
In the special master's report, as I saw it, it said that the money was accounted for But you're saying the retroactive aspect of it is clear in the special master's?
I believe in the further write-up later, the initial findings up front were more general, but when he discussed it later, it was more specific, I believe, Your Honor. I want to touch briefly on the timing issue. Appellants have raised an issue about the last motion for summary judgment that was brought. I will refer to that as the motion that relates to the December 2009 transactions. In our initial summary judgment, at that time, based on the record at that time, we did say we're not seeking summary judgment because we believe there, at that time, there was a genuine issue of material fact. That changed with the pretrial submissions. When plaintiffs came in with a motion to seek to amend their answer to assert an affirmative defense of fraud in the factum, which requires as an element of that, that the documents were actually signed. So we now have new admissions that hadn't been made before. May I briefly finish this?
You may.
Thank you. We have new admissions that had not been made before that contradicted other statements that had been made before and culminated with counsel saying they don't really know what happened. So based on those new facts, the new motion was brought. In response to that, they could have come forward with admissible evidence to say, we signed them, we didn't sign them. They did not do that. And based on that, I don't know, there's cases cited in our brief, I don't know is not sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact. With that, Your Honor, my time's up. We respectfully ask that the court affirm. We have a cross appeal. I believe that that's adequately covered in the briefing.
Yes, and we have your briefing.
Thank you.
So, counsel, for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to address first Steve Lindholm and some of the comments made by his attorney, Kevin Strupp. He admits that the relationship between Steve Lindholm and my clients was messy and not normal. And in the record, I mean, there's been a ton of briefing on the summary judgment motion by Steve Lindholm. The record shows all the texts and emails and constant communication with Steve Lindholm. That clearly brings a question of fact for a jury. In summary judgment, the facts are supposed to be thought of in favor of the person defending the motion for summary judgment. Here, it's the judge is making the determinations of fact. The judge has become the fact finder and has deprived my clients of their constitutional right to a jury trial. And the settlement negotiations are not relevant to this appeal. With regard to John Bloom,
what is the amount of the specific financial damages that your client identified for the Supreme Court to avoid summary judgment?
To the district court?
The district court, I'm sorry.
We did not have a specified amount of damages, but in the record, the damages can be ascertained by looking at what has been filed. We didn't file a separate piece of paper that said we're asking for these damages. But part of...
Where would I look in the record to find the most specific identification of the basis for your client's damages?
I would say in the response to the last summary judgment motion after the final pretrial hearing. And some of those damages relate to this conversion and civil theft claims.
Is there any other place that we could look to see a specific identification by your clients of the damages or the basis for those specific damages?
There are, and I apologize, tell you exactly which briefs they're in, but there are discussions about interest on unsigned loans. And part of it is being able to assert the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, because that would allow, that would force the bank not to be able to enforce their alleged loan agreements, because they did breach the duty of good faith and fair dealing.
So was there any evidence presented to the district court to challenge the special master's alleged conclusion that any anomalies were retroactively fixed to to put your client in the same position your client would have been in had the funds gone to the proper loans or defaulted loans?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, when you asked Mr. Berger who found the error, it was I who found the error and wrote the bank repeatedly about that they couldn't apply that money to those extinguished notes. I was the one who did that. It took them months to fix it. We don't challenge a special master report. But the special master, just one instance where there are damages shown by the special master, it's when the bank took a cashier's check and held it for 13 days and my clients would have lost the interest on that money. And what the special master didn't do, though, the special master relied on John Bloom, and this is where Mr. Bloom's attorney is wrong, that there's nothing in the record that Mr. Bloom made a false statement. Mr. Bloom, on several occasions, and one in his second supplemental response to expedited request for information, which is in the special master report, as footnote 184 on page 51, it goes through all these unknown debits that the court ordered them to describe. And Mr. Bloom has always taken the position, and he did this with the special master, that those cashier's checks were just set aside. He told the special master they're put in a firebox, set aside. But that is absolutely not true. I went through every single cashier's check and every single cashier's check bank statement of the banks, and they immediately deposited every single check to the tune of $675,000 that my clients were deprived of. So Mr. Bloom had a false statement. There are other damages that are in the special master report and in my brief to the last.
And the evidence of that was provided by whom?
By appellants at the district court.
We say by appellants. What specific piece of evidence?
Oh, copies of the cashier's check statements, my affidavit, a spreadsheet of all the cashier's
checks.
Your
affidavit.
With attachments, of course. I have not, you know, contrary to what Mr. Bloom's attorney has said, I'm not making facts up. These are all based on affidavit evidence with things attached to the affidavit.
Right, but you're making interpretations of the evidence that you're asking us to rely upon. Was there some expert financial accountant or some other witness that would support, that has offered evidence that's that could be relied upon by a jury to support this $675,000, the claim that the cashier's check and its placement caused your client damages?
Your Honor, I mean, it's pretty rudimentary that if you take money unilaterally out of somebody's account with a cashier's check without the customer's approval, which is required by the checking account agreement, put it in your account, their bank account, the bank's, not applied to debt, so it wasn't as a set off. I don't think you need an expert to show when you have the paperwork to show it. You've got the cashier's check, the deposit into the bank's account.
You have the paper to show it, but you don't have an interpretation of the effect of the placement of the check.
Well,
the argument is being made that there was no harm, and I'm trying to get a sense of whether there's evidence in the record that a district court can rely upon as evidence that would have been presented to a jury to create a disputed fact issue on that.
Well, the disputed fact issue is, did the bank convert funds? They took funds that weren't theirs, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So our thanks to all counsel in this case. The matter is now submitted to us for our decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. And again, thanks for your presentation today. All right, with that, we have concluded our oral calendar for the day, and we will now be in recess for our non-oral calendar. Thank you.